such along those lines. And so we say there's at least an inference there that there was no bias. And what they're asking you to presume, in order to presume harm, I think Justice Spears alerted to earlier, they're asking you, number one, to presume that some jurors were biased against the plaintiff's case. They're asking you to assume, number two, that those particular jurors misled the court and counsel during voir dire when they were asked these other general questions about bias and prejudice, either about the lawsuit itself or about the damages they were seeking in that case. Then they're asking you to assume that if, in fact, they would have been allowed to go into the fact about the liability crisis, that these jurors who had been untruthful earlier in the general questions would have been truthful on those particular questions. And then they're asking you to assume that if there were jurors such as that anyway, they violated the oath they took as jurors, and they violated the court's instructions to render their decision based only on the evidence, and that despite the fact they came in and found that even though the evidence showed that we did fail, allegedly, to properly protect our heels, they came in and answered that negatively also. We say that that's just too many presumptions. The law requires them to show harm. The law does not state at this time that you can presume harm in a case such as this.
Let me ask you.
Yes.
You know, showing harm is difficult. Judge Barrow, when he was on the San Antonio court, wrote an opinion, I think it's called Leatherman versus Cartel, in which he said that in a closely contested case, the admission or the exclusion of testimony, based on what he wrote, this court, Roper, said the same thing. If it's a closely contested case, something comes in, or something's excluded that shouldn't have been, then harm is there. Do you have any comment you make on that? Because to show harm, you know, is a kind of an amorphous...
All I can say, Your Honor, is you know, we've had Rule 81 for some time. The case law in this particular area requires a showing of harm. I agree that it could be difficult to do. But on the other hand, I think it's more illogical or speculative, if you will, to presume that there had been harm in this case, that jurors would have come in there and answered the issue about properly protecting her heels. They answered it incorrectly because of some refusal to go into media crisis questions. I think that's a lot more far-fetched than the other. And my point is the rules require them to show harm. We cited Johnson versus Reed in our brief, which states that unless you do show harm in a situation similar to this, that it's not reversible error.
Mr. Cruz,
yes.
Let's put preservation of error aside. How do you respond to the pretty stout affidavit with regard to what happened in a similar trial or a medical malpractice trial? This few doors down,
well,
where 20-odd jurors were challenged for cause because of prejudice in this area.
I was just going to address that, Your Honor, and we have addressed that fairly lengthy in our briefs. But number one, the affidavits were not timely. Number two, the affidavit from his partner about what happened in another lawsuit, when we don't have the statement of fact, when we weren't there, but weren't allowed to cross-examine him, if you will. I mean, it's just blatant hearsay, and it's we say it's of no effect at all. It certainly isn't in the trial record any showing of harm. And we say that it's of no effect at all. The other affidavit they got, it was 11-1 jury verdict. They went to the one juror who did not go with us in the case, and she made these comments about the other juror. Well, one of the defendants, I don't remember if it was us or not, got the affidavit from the other juror saying that's not true, and I answered all the questions honestly. So that negates out the other affidavit, if anything. And again, we say that the affidavit from the other juror is improper. There's no law, as was pointed out, showing that that's proper to use it and that it shouldn't be used because of Rule 327. So in summary, we say, first of all, that they never preserved their error as they're required to do, that they didn't... as you'll see from reading the transcript, at any time submit a list of questions like they said they were going to do later on. We say further that the court did not abuse his discretion under the circumstances in this particular case. And further, we say that if, in fact, the court finds that he did abuse his discretion, that they haven't shown that it was harmful error. And we would pray that the judgments of the trial court and the Court of Appeals be in all things affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. After hearing the remarks of counsel for respondent, it seems apparent that there is no longer any dispute about the fact that a trial judge who issues a blanket prohibition against all questions concerning this area of the liability crisis or the lawsuit crisis, that's an abuse of discretion. That's just not denied. Nobody disputes that. The question is whether it was harmful in this case and whether error was preserved in this case, and that's what I want to address myself to in this rebuttal. First of all, concerning the preservation of error, there was a misrepresentation made, I'm sure innocently, by Mr. Cruz concerning the motions in limine. Two of the three motions in limine filed by defendants had specific paragraphs that said that the plaintiff should not be allowed to ask the jury or talk during the trial about the lawsuit crisis or the liability crisis, or I can't remember the exact wording, but it's in supplemental transcript number 2, pages 1 and 7, have paragraphs that specifically address the problems that came up in this case. It was discussed in that motion in limine pretrial conference, and the judge made a ruling that the plaintiffs could not get into that area at all. The next time it came up was in the middle of the voir dire process, and at that point, Mr. Hensarling said, Your Honor, I would like to bring out the court's ruling on my motion, that is, their motion, in limine. It's my understanding that the court has precluded me from asking questions as to whether the jury has heard or read about not necessarily the insurance crisis, but the liability crisis and the lawsuit crisis. Then he talks about this juror, and he says, I think that brings forth the need and the necessity for a fair trial, that the plaintiff be allowed to go into this in a little more depth with the rest of the jurors. So he identifies what...
I missed the point. Is this before or after the jury was seated?
This was during the voir dire process, well before the jury was seated, Your Honor, while the jurors were being questioned. And he clearly identifies what it is he wants to talk about. Judge Touche, in response, says, let the record show that that was made, carefully considered, and the same ruling is in effect.
Where are you on the statement of facts? Yeah.
Page 55, volume 1, the statement of facts is this discussion. Let the record show that was made, carefully considered, and the same ruling, that is the ruling on the motions in limine, is in effect. Otherwise, it would open the door completely to both sides to go into that, which would completely prejudice the jury, and we couldn't get a fair trial.
How about volume 2, page 4, the flip side of that, where Judge Touche apparently, the legislature said, I've never denied you an opportunity to make a bill of exception.
First of all, that's not where he says that. There is a request made in volume 2, page 4.
Well, he's parading a page down there, unless he's lying, quoted a page number and a volume.
Your Honor, he did say that, and I'm not saying he didn't say that. This is not where he said it. It was later in the trial, and it's cited in the respondent's brief. Later in the trial in regard to a different bill of exceptions for a witness that was made after the jury went out. And the judge said, in a very self-serving remark, I have never denied you the right to make a bill of exceptions. I don't think that means that he didn't deny it. Otherwise, any trial judge could, at the end of any trial, say, on the record, I have not made any errors in this trial.
It was not challenged by counsel?
I don't think it needs to be challenged, Your Honor. It's a simple, self-serving statement made on the record that he hasn't denied him the right to make a bill of exceptions. What he does do, and I do want to discuss this on page 4 of volume 2 of the statement of facts, Mr. Hensarling says,
Before you get to that, what about the argument that Judge Touche asked on the first day of trial if anybody had any objections to the seating of the jury, and nobody made any objections at that time, which is, I understand it, if you agree with the chronology, was the evening before the remarks you're about to go into.
That's right, Your Honor. What he said is that after the clerk went through and struck certain jurors, and everybody was looking at that list, and the judge said, does anybody have any objections to these jurors? And Mr. Hensarling, thinking he meant, did they get the list right, said, no, I don't have any objection to them. That doesn't mean I approve of the whole jury selection process. He had already made his objection about not being allowed to go into this area. Went home and thought about it the next morning and said, maybe I better bring this up again.
Do you think that as of that time, without going into volume 2, page 4, that Mr. Hensarling had properly preserved error based on what had been done?
Yes, I do,
Your
Honor. That's right.
So anything else from then on is just icing on the cake?
I think that's true. I think it's worth considering because it demonstrates that he continued to make efforts to apprise the judge of the mistake he'd made and give him an opportunity to correct it. For example, the questions that were tendered after trial are probably of no effect whatsoever, and maybe Mr. Hensarling shouldn't have even tried that. But I think it was just another good faith effort on his part to try to get this in front of the judge to show him what he would have asked. But I think that it wasn't even necessary to propose that specific list of questions. Now, on page 4 of volume 2 of the Statement of Facts, Mr. Hensarling says, "I understand your ruling's already been made, but I would ask that at some recess, maybe today or late this afternoon, I be allowed to put those questions that I would have asked in the record so they might be reviewed later on if necessary." And in response to that, Judge Touche said, "Let the record show this matter's been ruled on twice. This request that's made is carefully considered by this court and denied." Now, there's a clear request there by Mr. Hensarling. Didn't use the words bill of exceptions, but he said, "I want to put my questions in the record," and in response, the judge says that request is denied. Now, regardless of what the judge says later about never denying him the right to make a bill of exceptions, I think that's where it occurs.
Again, that's after the jury is seated.
That's right, Your Honor. But before any evidence has started to come in, it's immediately after the jury's been
seated. Critical stage before the seating of the jury, and you've got the way I view the world. Things have to be done a certain way before the jury is seated, or perhaps they're waived.
That may be true with regard to some matters, Your Honor. I'm not aware of any law that says that specific court-hour questions have to be put into the record before the jury is seated. Again, the trial court's blanket refusal of all of these questions, I think, makes this really kind of a moot point. Judge Touche had made it clear at that point that he was not going to allow any questions. It's just a matter of when to take care of the housekeeping detail of putting it in the record. And when Mr. Hensarling asked to do it, the judge said, "No, you can't do it." And the respondent's argument is, well, he didn't come back later that afternoon and say, "Can I do it now? Can I do it now?" Question is, how many times do you have to ask? I think the rules are you ask once, and when that request is denied, you've preserved error. There was a question asked about what law supports the respondent's view of this situation, and Mr. Cruz said the case of Fenton versus Wade. Fenton versus Wade was considerably different from this case. If we look at that case, it's a little bit hard to tell from the court's description, but my best guess is that that was a case where the voir dire was not recorded at all, because what the court says in its opinion is that the questions aren't on the record, the judge's ruling isn't on the record, the entire proceedings are not on the record, and that is quite different from what we have in this case.
Any cases of recorded voir dire where this kind of general submission of an area and a blanket rejection of that has been held to be sufficient?
I do not, Your Honor. As far as I know, this case is
a
first impression.
We're kind of writing on a clean slate.
That's right.
So what we really have to do is take Rule 52A. It says, in order to preserve a complaint, a party must present to the trial court a timely request stating the specific grounds for the ruling he desires to make if the specific grounds are not apparent from the context.
That's right. That's,
and we have to interpret that into these facts.
Right. And the specifics that they're talking about, it does not say specific evidence or specific questions. It's talking about grounds for what the party wants to do. And I think Mr. Hensarling has made it clear why he wants to go into these areas. And the rule says if those grounds are clear, then you don't need to go into the specific reasons. The other point raised by the respondents in this regard is that the harm, the supposed harm from allowing
these... Before you move off of that, are you going to literally interpret 52B, the cause of the word evidence in there, say that that cannot be applicable to voir dire?
That's a tough call, Your Honor. I'll concede that, and I think we prevail either way, because if voir dire questions are like evidence, then we're subject to the same rules in 52 that says if it's clear from the context what would have been asked, then you don't need to perfect a bill of exceptions. But yes, I do interpret it literally, and I think when the rules say evidence, they don't mean voir dire questions. They're a little bit different. Respondent suggests that the harm of asking questions like this is that it injects insurance into any case, because if you talk to jurors and say, "Are you aware of this media information about the liability crisis?" that somehow injects insurance. If that is true, then it is not the plaintiffs who have injected insurance into the case, because these advertisements we've been talking about, which are in the appendix of our brief, are sponsored by the insurance industry and say in almost every advertisement at the bottom, Aetna Insurance Company or some other insurance company, so that the insurance companies have, in effect, injected insurance into every personal injury case where those potential jurors sit. They have made the choice of identifying themselves with that position, and it is not the plaintiffs who ask these questions that inject insurance into the case. The last issue I want to address concerns the harm that was presented in this case by the failure to allow these questions. Now, respondents suggest that we are asking you to presume that there were 11 jurors that were affected by this kind of media advertising and changed their verdict in this case. That's not what we have to do to show harm. This was an 11-to-1 verdict. If two different jurors that would have been eliminated by these kind of questions and stricken for cause, served on this jury, and voted against this plaintiff and prevented a hung jury, then the harm is demonstrated. And we have evidence from one of these jurors demonstrating three different names of people that did talk about the fact that they were tired of lawsuits and tired of big verdicts and looking forward to tort reform. So in that regard, the harm has been demonstrated. There was also an argument made that can't we assume from this case that the jurors were not tainted because they did not respond to the general questions about bias and prejudice. I think anybody who's been a trial attorney or a trial judge that's witnessed board hour examinations knows that jurors are not likely to respond to general questions, but a lot more likely to respond to specific questions. And exactly what happened in this case, the general questions were asked, the jurors said, we don't have any general bias, yet they got in the courtroom and started talking about the very things that we wanted to talk about in this case. That's the harm. That's why we need to ask these questions. In respondents' argument, they said that Judge Touche in this case was trying to strike a balance. And our point is that that's exactly what he failed to do. That's why he abused his discretion. He did not strike a balance. He did not say, let me consider your questions one by one, and you can ask some and you can't ask others. But he says in several places on this record that I'm not going to allow any questions about this whole area, and that's where the abuse of discretion occurred. It was harmful to the specific plaintiffs in this case. It was sufficiently preserved on the record by the requirements of Rule 52. And for that reason, we ask that this court reverse the decision of the trial court and the appellate court, that it remand the case to the district court for a new trial with specific instructions to allow board hour examination about the liability crisis.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take another brief recess.